All right, so my journalism career here didn't get off to an auspicious start. I started here at Swarthmore College on the Phoenix. I don't know how many of you might remember Tarbell when it was still in existence up the hill there. The Phoenix was in the basement. It was a very dingy operation and not exactly high quality journalism, right? So I was my first time there, I was asked to do a little bit of copy editing, write a headline for this thing. So I got handed this notice, and it said, it was from the debate club, and it talked about their first event of the season where they happened not to win. And so, you know, being the clever undergraduate that I was, I wrote a headline that said, "Debate, debut, debacle." And shortly thereafter, Jim Hempel, class of 78, running the debate club, kindly informed us at the Phoenix that it was forensics and it wasn't the first time they'd ever done anything. And, you know, it was kind of a close loss. And he said, it was neither debate, nor debut, nor debacle. And, anyway, so fast forward 35 years later, I'm taking a lifelong learning class up the hill with Professor Cooper Berg from the economics department. And who would be one of my classmates but Mr. Hempel? Fortunately, I decided that the statute of limitations on that offense had run, and I did not fess up to it. Speaking of things that a newspaper might want to disavow, I now work for the Patriot News and its associated website, Penn Live in Harrisburg. And the Patriot News operates under a very heavy burden, for those of you who know your history. It is known as the paper that 150 years ago trashed the Gettysburg Address, right? Okay, yes. The editorial writer at the time called them silly remarks, deserving a veil of oblivion. And for the 150th anniversary of the address, we decided, you know, that we had to correct this historical nonsense. So I wrote the retraction editorial, trying to channel my inner Abraham Lincoln, and I wrote explaining what might have happened back in the time. I said that this mistake had occurred under the influence of partisanship or strong drink, as was common in the profession at the time. And I got several responses that suggested I and my colleagues might be nipping the sauce ourselves. So it's just the kind of feedback you get when you work in the trade. Anyway, I did warn people that you would be quizzed on your news consumption habits. So we're going to distribute a technologically wizardous device that will enable you to help share information about your news consumption habits, and I'm sure the National Security Administration will be glad to get this information from you. If it were up to me, you know, I wouldn't share it with them. But so what we're going to do is these iClickers will be distributed to you, and there's a power button at the bottom, and there are choices A, B, C, and D, buttons A, B, C, and D for giving answers. And I'll let you think about the first question as we go here. We will go to, there we go. Did you read a daily newspaper, ink on paper version, yesterday? This is a pretty standard survey question in the business. And we will, whoops, we better make sure we're, yeah, here we go. Turn it on to the base connection and... All right, it's booting up as we speak. Okay, we hope it's booting up. I might need Andrew's help on this. Ah, okay. The voting is now open. More than once? Gosh, I hope not. Man. All right, I want to see your voter IDs before you can push that button, sorry. All right, okay. Has everybody got their clicker?
And does it have blue light?
When it's on, it should have a blue light, right? Okay. Yes, the blue light should be at the top. Okay. Shall the clerk lock the roll? Everybody voted. Does anybody wish to change their vote? Okay. All right. I will stop the voting, and let's see if we can put up what the results are. Oops. Move over there. Uh-oh, I may need Andrew's help to get this over there. Hmm. How's that not moving over there?
Click the very top.
Click the bar? Oh, click the bar. There we go. That's why he's here. Okay, so what do we have? We have roughly 74% read a daily newspaper. You other 24% will be talked to. Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting because that is considerably higher than the population at large. I'm sure you're not surprised to hear that. Now, this is what you'd call the money shot question. How many of you paid for that newspaper? I'm sorry? Oh, graph is still up. Well, let's get rid of that graph. There we go. Okay. So, did you pay for that newspaper and how? Can everybody see your choices? Yes, that's true. There, and if we have more responses to this question than we had to the first one, we'll know somebody needs to be talked to. Yes. All right, let's, I'm sorry. We may not have opened the voting in time. Okay, now we're ready to go. Actually, I hadn't started the thing, so on this one, you should go ahead. And
if you don't get a green light after you vote,
so are we getting our green lights?
Press on it for longer than a second.
Okay, does anybody need technical assistance or are we good? Okay, we're good. All right, let's stop the voting here and let's see if we can get the instant results up. Oh, I had them up. There they are. Okay. We have one very honest person. Okay. Well, That's very gratifying, and if there were more of you who answered A, the newspapers would be in much better shape these days. All right, so let's close that one. Let's go on to the next one. Did that go off? Yes, it did. All right. So how often do you read that ink on newspaper? Pretty much every day, Sunday only, somewhere in between, or I don't read them anymore. It will be open momentarily. I should open it as soon as I put that up. It's open now.
Can this be a weekly like the Swarthmore?
if you read it every day. Okay. Should we go ahead and close the voting? All right, let's see what we got here. Oh, we got a lot of everyday readers. That's excellent. Okay. Sunday only is only about 5. I was expecting more of Sunday only. And we have 4 very high-tech people that don't read them anymore. Okay, well, you will be forgiven at some point. All right, next question. Just trying to find out what people read. I used to work at the Inquirer, so I was curious about this. Do you read the Inquirer? Let me open the voting here. There we go. Everybody had enough time? Okay, we'll stop that and let's see what we got. Oh, pretty good readership. That's excellent. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Pleasantly surprised there, because I've certainly heard from a number of people who have decided otherwise, and I am Sunday only now. Okay, let's go on to the next. This would be the New York Times, and the voting is open. And again, we're asking ink on paper, because I do want to distinguish between the physical product and the digital product. All right, everybody set? Let's see how the nation's leading journalistically responsible newspaper is. Oh, pretty good. 53%. Okay. All right. Let's go on to the next, which would be the paper that everybody in business reads, and the voting's open. What I'm trying to get at here is get some sense of these national publications, how they compare to the Metro, readership of the Metro product. Okay, we've closed the voting on that one, and we have, we don't have a lot. Oh, you liberal arts people. All right. Well, you know, can't you deduct it on your taxes? I mean, that's what everybody, I guess, the Wall Street Journal does. Okay, all right, so we'll move on to the next here. Now, the creme de la creme of the national newspapers, USA Today. Does anybody read this? Sorry, I laughed, but go ahead and let me know. Yeah, I know. Not a scientific survey. This definitely comes with an asterisk here. Okay. All right, let's see. Whoa! Ow! You're hurt. Alan Newharth is crying to hear you say that. Okay, all right. Well, no surprise there. I mean, nobody's traveled to a hotel and just picked it up for real. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, once in a while, but not regularly. Yeah, understood. Okay, all right. And now, I did hear some remarks about other newspapers of less prominence, so let's ask this question. Do you read a suburban or local paper with any regularity? Yes, it should say suburban or highly local newspaper. It is open. Okay. Anybody set? Okay. Let's see what kind of results we got here. Okay. Yeah, we got a fair amount of readership for local products. That's 63%. That's very good. Okay. Well, we know... We know this is an urbane and sophisticated crowd here, so I have to ask this question as well. Do you read a paper we haven't mentioned? Maybe you get a foreign newspaper, The Guardian, or a foreign language. This is just for fun. Still talking ink and paper, so yeah, that would be a... I'll take whatever answer you give. Okay. Yeah, details. Okay. All right, let's see what we got here. Whoa. Okay, well, we have a few people that are reading another product. All right. Well, that concludes this portion. As I suspected, we have an audience here which is educated, pays attention, a little bit older demographic, reads a lot of newspapers. That's a good thing for people like me that started in the business 30 years ago. This kind of fun fact here. In 1950, if you added up all the circulation of American newspapers and divided it by the number of households, you had 1.3 newspapers per household. You know, some got two, some got none. The average was 1.3. And today it's dropped by two-thirds. It's less than four-tenths of a newspaper per household. So it's...
weekly or daily?
This is daily. Yeah, it's It's been quite a change. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this little portion of our presentation aside, and we're going to take a quick tour through American newspaper history in order to kind of figure out where we've been and well, let me rephrase. Let me back up. Okay. Before we get to newspaper history, we want let me talk about how people or how newspapers are doing in this day and age. The Philadelphia Inquirer, I was pleasantly surprised to see the readership level there because, as you know, it's been under quite a lot of strain. It's had five owners in 6 years. Knight Ritter sold it to McClatchy, who sold it to Brian Tierney and his group, who sold it to a private equity firm, which owned it when I was working there. And then the private equity firm sold it to George Norcross and Jerry Landfest and several others. And you probably know that there's quite a bit of consternation going on there right now. That's the kind of turmoil we're seeing in the newspaper industry these days. At its peak, the Inquirer had a newsroom staff of about 700. And today it's in the low 200s, so it's really it has really fallen from grace here. I'm going to skip over that slide. Let me ask you this question. Now that we've talked about the print side of things, do you get any news? I call it word news. By electronic means. This could be internet or smartphone. Let's open the voting on that one and see if we get much difference here between what you get online. And it's interesting that, you know, we might think of the internet and the smartphone as being one and the same, but they're actually very different platforms for the purposes of those who are trying to figure out an economic model to make this business work. Let's see what the results are here. We do have some very high news consumption here. Well, so we have a lot of dual platform news consumers here, which is a good thing. And let's go on to how many articles you read, because one of the things that's interesting about internet news consumption is that it tends to be in bits and bytes, small chunks over, spread out over time. So let's see how much your, charts on there, sorry about that. There we go. So we have 0, 1 to 4, 5 to 10, or 11 or more. Yeah, let's say yesterday. That's fine. All right, let's see what kind of answer we get to y'all. 1 to 4 is the most common. And that is what they find in the industry, that, you know, these are little, you know, quick hit kind of visits, which is different from a newspaper, because with a newspaper, you unfold, you know, you spend a lot of time with it. So this tends to be more like pinprick reading. Now, here's a question that gets to the heart of what's going to happen to newspapers and so forth. Did you pay anything for reading that news online or on your smartphone? I'm guessing what the answer is going to be. I would say you have paid for that. Good question, though. No, the question would be, are you paying the content provider for the content on a regular basis as opposed to one time only, you know, setting up something?
But the New York Times app,
you pay for it. You pay a subscription fee for it? Okay. Yeah, if you pay like a subscription, let's count that. So let's see how we're doing with this economic model. Actually, a fair amount of people paying for it, like one-third, two-thirds almost. So there's hope. There's hope. That is a good thing. Throw in this last question just for fun. Have you read a digital replica of a printed newspaper? That's where they actually take a picture of it and put it up, you know, in PDF format. So I'm sorry, I forgot to open the voting. There we go, voting's open. The digital replica is, does it look exactly like the printed edition on your computer?
Yes.
Okay, that's what we're after. Yep. Okay, let's see what kind of results we got on this one. Oh, well, we have 12 digital replica readers. It's interesting because when the whole internet revolution thing first started when I was in Anchorage, I thought the digital replica version of it might be the killer app that sort of bridged the two, especially if they would build in hyperlinks, you know, so that you could click through to more information and find the sourcing and so forth. But that was not technologically possible with the model we had at that time. And this has sort of been the, you know, the stepchild model of digital that it may be making a bit of a comeback now. But we shall see. All right, so just for fun, demographics, your age group. Let's open the voting on this one. I tried to get my son to come to help drive down the average age of the group, but he didn't want to come. So, okay. All right, let's lock the voting on that one. And okay. Well, this is not uncommon in the newspaper reading world to see older readers reading more. Okay. And finally, the other big theme that we'll see in newspaper readership is your level of education. Oh, open the voting. Sorry about that. That's what she's here for. Okay. I'm really dying to see how many people are modest. Oops, stop. Okay. All right. Well, very highly educated audience. So, again, you know, older readers, more highly educated, out of fear that the NSA might be listening, I didn't ask about your income, but, you know, we would find that people with higher incomes are generally consuming more of the print product. But the industry is under stress because, I'll get rid of the chart, thank you. The industry is under stress. As you can see, the revenue trend there from 2003 all the way down to 2012, quite a plummet, down by 50%. The dark thing at the top is digital. You can see that it's getting a little bit bigger, but not nearly fast enough to offset the decline. It's called trading dollars, print dollars for digital dimes, is the way it was referred to in the business when I was doing it.
Well, and there was about a 3-year period, it went down about 50%.
Yeah, yeah, it's bounced back a little bit, and we'll get to some of the economic factors that involved there. So profit margins are falling, but what's interesting is if you look in the middle of that graph, the peak is around 2000, the early 2000s. There's a little bit of a dip there from September 11th in the middle of the graph, but you can see that it was well up over 25%. So at one point, these institutions were, you know, big money makers, and now we're down to 15%, which is still decent. This is operating profit. So if you have a very heavy debt, like some operations do, the making 15% operating, you know, isn't enough to dig you out of your hole. And that is one of the issues that is facing the once mighty Inquirer. That's the building it occupied in 1924 up until last year. I had the privilege of working in there for a while when it was about 15% occupied. And now the Inquirer is just another tenant in Center City, at least the newsroom. They have the printing plant out in suburbia. And you can see, we'll look at what some stock prices have done. You know, newspapers made great money, and they were great investments for a while. You can look at some of the peaks. Gannett peaked at 90, hit a low of 8 during the crash, now at 25. McClatchy, which owned the Anchorage paper where I worked, $70 a share. Some of my colleagues actually bought it through the employee plan at that price. Fell all the way down to 60 cents, now in the $3 range. It's a very debt-heavy company. Lee Enterprises, $49, now $3 a share. New York Times, you know, the one that everybody's rooting to make it as a national newspaper, $48.60 to $14 a share. Media General, which we'll talk about a little bit later, $71.88 peak, now under $20 a share. So you can see the industry is under tremendous economic strain. Now we're going to go on a slide-free tour of U.S. newspaper history. I'll try to do this quickly so that we can talk about kind of what newspapers were like throughout American history and see what it might tell us about where they go from here. Let's see how. You'll find a mix, as we go through this history, you'll find a mix of entrepreneurial capitalism, political motives, and surprisingly, government policy plays a much bigger role than I realized as I was digging into this. And these factors all mix together with technological change, changes in society, and also political developments. First newspaper in America, Boston Newsletter, 1704, John Campbell. He was a printer. He was trying to make money. He said, gee, I got a printing press. Maybe I can do something else with it. So he tried a newspaper. He struggled with a conundrum that continues to this day. Readers don't want to pay the full price for the information the publication is delivering them. He found an outlet with the colonial government. The colonial government, which was one of his printing customers, realized, this guy's getting information out to people. We can use him. So he ended up being a semi-official outlet for the colonial government there. Well, you can imagine that didn't sit well with some Bostonians. So 20 years later, we have a different paper emerging run by one James Franklin called the New England Courant. And he launches a crusade for smallpox inoculation. There was an epidemic going around at the time. So here we have the crusading newspaper being born just 20 years after the first newspaper comes out. And because the other one was sort of a semi-official organ of the government, James Franklin was no big fan of the government and actually got put in jail for a while for being so anti-government. So we begin to see the tension between the independent press and the government. Now, Franklin had a younger brother working with him as an apprentice. His brother got fed up with all that stuff there in Boston, and he fled to Philadelphia. He founded a paper called the Pennsylvania Gazette, 1729. You may recognize his first name, Benjamin Franklin. Noteworthy as the first time someone in America turned a newspaper into a great source of wealth. Franklin really wanted to become a mover and shaker, and he thought, hey, there's this newspaper that's already in existence. I'm going to buy it, I'm going to make it better, and I'm going to make a lot of money. And that's exactly what he did. He sold it for a huge profit after less than 20 years.
But Deborah was his financial officer, so give Deborah some credit.
Okay, well, there you go. Deborah gets credit. Okay, so how a paper related to the government was important, as I mentioned. A lot of times the publisher would be the postmaster for the colonial government, which gave you good access to gossip when people came to pick up their mail. You might also be able to hassle your rivals a little bit that way. Colonial government had printing contracts. So the Boston Newsletter kind of followed that model. But you find newspapers growing in reaction to that, as James Franklin's did. You have newspapers becoming the voice of the disaffection that Americans had with colonial rule by the British. So this was an era when the political mission was seen as more important than the money-making motive. It really became a voice for disaffected people who were upset with British rule. For example, I was surprised by this. Tom Paine's first revolutionary essay appeared in a publication called the Pennsylvania Packet and General Advertiser. So they're trying to do both, but they have a political agenda there as well. The Packet probably wasn't too worried about losing Tory customers. So when the revolution was won, the political dimension of newspapers remained strong. There was this huge tension between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, the Jeffersonians and the Adams visions, strong central government, more decentralized government. Huge battle that makes what we're going through these days, you know, look like kid's play. there were different papers on different sides. Jefferson recruited a couple papers to be founded, Philip Freneau in the National Gazette. There was a virulently anti-federalist paper run by Benjamin Bosch. John Fenno founded a pro-federalist paper called the Gazette of the United States. Alexander Hamilton promoted the founding of the New York Post to give the Federalist point of view a wider dimension. And the disputes between these institutions, pro- and anti-federalist papers, were so virulent that they actually had violence. Benjamin Bosch, who had attacked George Washington as, you know, being a scum traitor to his country, I mean, almost in those words, and the pro-Federalist folks actually beat him up and ransacked his offices. So it was a rugged time in American journalism. So by 1800, we have most commercial cities getting at least one daily paper. Philadelphia had six, but Boston had none, interesting. One of the things that helped it along was favorable postal rates. 1782 and 1792, there were postal rate decisions made that were helpful to the distribution of newspapers by mail. And then, of course, we had Americans pushing out on the frontier at the same time, and the papers weren't far behind. First came weeklies. And they were sort of like the blogs of today. They were a lot of recycled news from other sources. Sound familiar with blogs? A lot of gossip and commentary and readers' gripes. But one thing that helped them along was legal ads. You know, as commerce came out and followed, they realized, you know, need a little bit of government to regulate commerce. Oh, yeah, so we have legal ads. So newspapers are starting to find a way to get a little bit of money there. And I didn't realize this, but in 1814, the federal government said that laws must be published in at least two newspapers, I believe it was per state and territory. So you have the government basically saying newspapers are a form of information distribution that we want to take advantage of, and that really helped push the growth of newspapers on the frontier. And so we're seeing a shift away from Federalist domination of the papers, because the Federalists were kind of the establishment at the time, you know, hard money, good money, as opposed to easy money for the farmers and the yeoman tradesmen. And as the suffrage, as the vote begins to expand in the early 1800s, you get a, we're beginning to see the Jacksonian democracy revolution, or, you know, Jacksonian ferment, the average person as opposed to elites. So you're seeing a little bit wider market for information in politics open up, and advertising is not far behind. By the 1820s, it was common for papers to have names like Advertiser or Mercantile, something like that. The Depression of 1828-29 kind of put a damper on things, but coming out of that, we have Benjamin Day founding the New York Sun. He's a printer again. He's like, maybe I can do a newspaper. He founds the first of the penny, what becomes called the penny press. He charges 1 cent and tries to get a really broad audience. And it works. 2 years later, he has 15,000 circulation. Others come into the, you know, follow this model of the penny press, New York Herald, New York Tribune. The guys who run the presses have to run to keep up. So we have technology coming behind saying, you know, hey, we're going to get better presses so that we can get these, you know, everybody wants our paper. So you have technology doing this push me, pull you thing where they're selling more, so they got to print faster. And once they print faster, then they can sell more. So we really begin to see quite a growth of circulation at this point. And it's the first time when newspapers get big enough to really start doing their own news gathering as opposed to just sort of taking it from other sources like the blogs do today. Then the telegraph comes in, which really brings, it kind of speeds up the news cycle, as it were. Instead of taking weeks to get information from over, you know, from parts of the country, you can get it by telegraph. So that gives people a reason to start looking for papers more often. So technology, again, helps drive the growth of the audience. But you still see political orientation being strong in newspapers at this point. And the example is the Patriot Union in Harrisburg, my own paper, 1863, didn't like Lincoln one whit. It was a copperhead paper, Democrat, anti-Lincoln, anti-war, and, you know, not really all that bugged by slavery either, I'm sorry to say. So you see that there were still political, there's definitely political orientation going on here, even as readership is building. But after the war, you see the gradual emergence of a more journalistically oriented newspaper. You have the transatlantic cable coming across right after the war, so it's, again, speeds up the news cycle, builds a demand for more information quicker. You have education expanding. So the politics is getting toned down a little bit, but they're trying to grab readers with corruption crusades like Tammany Hall, Thomas Nast, you know, in New York, crusading against corruption. You had Grant and the Credit Mobilier scandal. So things are building to the point where newspapers are really going to take off in the second, in the latter part of the 1800s. So by 1900, we have almost 2,000 daily newspapers, and that's a fourfold increase. And the daily circulation is 15 million, which is a sixfold increase. And again, it's being helped along by government policy. In 1885, the Postal Service charges a penny a pound for newspapers. It's like, cool, this is cheap. You know, we can get our newspapers out. Started rural free delivery in 1897, which gets it out to the, you know, to the hinterlands at an affordable price. So this is the area when we begin to see press barons emerge, William Randolph Hearst, Joseph Pulitzer, they get into circulation wars. We have yellow journalism, sensationalism, but we also have some real journalism going on. One of my favorite charges from my career is when people would say, you know, oh, that was just a sensational story. You were just trying to sell newspapers. And, you know, the answer was like, okay, what's your point? Yeah, we're trying to sell our product. There are ways you can do it responsibly and irresponsibly, and there certainly were irresponsible promotions. My favorite, actually much earlier, was the Man on the Moon hoax run by the New York Sun in the 1830s. Like, they really ran with that, and people unfortunately bought it. Another technological thing that helped newspapers grow, photographs, 1897. Wasn't possible to take selfies and put them up on the internet, you know? People, like, they wanted to see this new technology, and newspapers were a way to distribute it. And as more readers came in, advertising dollars came after them as a way to, you know, to reach them, and papers became big profitable businesses. And what we begin to see is this bifurcation of how newspapers are run. You have, it used to be, you know, one guy was sort of in charge of everything, business, you know, news content, what they said politically, everything. It was, you know, pretty clearly a one-man show as regards who was in charge and ran things. But now it's getting to be such a big business that it's too much. And so you begin to see people running the financial stuff and people running the news content things. And that evolves into what we see today of editors and publishers. Editors, you know, trying to get as much money out of publishers as they can, and publishers trying to keep editors from costing them circulation and ads. That tension between business and the journalism side begins to emerge in the late 1800s, early 1900s, as newspapers really get to be a pretty substantial business. And around this time, we see the emergence of chains. Hearst and Pulitzer are building newspaper empires, become very powerful. World War I helped the consolidation because newsprint shortages and high costs, so papers go out of business. Presses are bigger. They take a lot of money to run them, so you need circulation to drive them. And if you're weaker, you can easily be culled from the herd. The news becomes a little more standardized, a little bit less political because, you know, hey, you got this big overhead. You need to, you know, get people to buy your product. You don't want to piss them off too much. One thing that I did not realize was a huge factor in newspaper consolidation was the Associated Press had a local monopoly. If you were a paper and you had the Associated Press, the Associated Press would not serve the other papers in your market, which was news to me. And so a lot of times, a weaker paper that had the Associated Press contract or rights would be bought out by a more aggressive paper that wanted to get the AP rights. And so that helped drive consolidation a lot. And that government, that was really an antitrust thing, and the Supreme Court finally put the kibosh on that in 1945. But Scripps and Hearst, like when they were building their empire, they killed off 31 papers between them. As they were building chains, Scripps ended up with about 29, and Hearst had about 20. In the 1920s is when somebody that we're familiar with today. His legacy, Frank Annette, starts buying small newspapers in New York. You hear the term menace of the chains. People are already starting to worry, you know, our newspapers getting too big and too powerful. The chains had 10% of daily circulation in 1900. It had grown to 41% by the middle of the Depression. But it was a regional, local kind of dominance, not a huge national reach. It's not like, you know, they had newspapers in every city and could sort of control the message in the news that way. It was more of a local, regional dominance. Chains reached their zenith in the 1930s, but the Depression was beginning to take its toll. Hearst, who had his, you know, zillion-dollar mansion up above the California coast, which my wife and I just visited last month, he had, during the Depression, had to sell off his zoo animals. He had, tough times. He had to sell off the polar bears. He had zebras. Some of the zebras are still running wild on his property today, which was a, you know, big surprise for us to learn. The Depression was a pressure source on newspapers. Radio was also a source of pressure, not so much on readership, but on ads. Radio was taking ad money from newspapers during the Depression. Radio ad revenue actually grew during the Depression, which surprised me because it was so new, and it was taking market share from newspapers. So a lot of pressure there from the overall economy, the Depression, on newspapers. One thing I didn't realize is that newspapers tried to cut radio out of the news business. Basically, there was a three-year period where newspapers got together and said, hey, don't be giving your stuff to radio before we can get the newspaper out the next day. And so it was kind of an organized boycott that newspapers tried to pull off from 1932 to 35, but it just kind of fizzled. People realized that, hey, that just isn't sustainable. It's not going to work. And I think newspapers eventually realized that they could be complementary to radio. Radio is great for breaking news and sort of you are there, you know, live. Newspapers have a little bit different role to play. TV also helped drive the shrinkage of the newspaper industry, as I'm sure you're all familiar, more immediate, more visual. But print newspaper owners responded by trying to buy TV stations, trying to buy radio stations, diversifying to help prop up their media empire. And there was quite a bit of that going on, and still is some today, although the FCC has weighed in with cross-ownership rules that try to limit that. Interesting, probably the pinnacle of media monopoly was in Kansas City. I didn't realize this, but one entity owned the morning paper, the evening paper, and the dominant radio station and the dominant TV station, and had 85% of the ad market. And the Justice Department weighed in at that point and said, nope, not good. And the Supreme Court eventually upheld that challenge, and it got broken apart. And so what happened with TV is it took away the national advertising papers. This was before my time as a reader, but papers used to have a lot of national ads in them. It was the way to get the message out before TV really took over. So TV siphons away national advertising from newspapers. So newspapers are left with this local, regional kind of clientele for ads. And what happens is you begin to get a kind of a cascade effect with advertising. If your main source is going to be local regional ads as opposed to national ads, then the local advertisers say, well, why do I need to be in two papers? There's probably a lot of overlap, and why don't I just get in the bigger one? So the advertisers go to the bigger one, and the bigger one has more money and can do better product, and so you begin to get this circle where more readers, more ads, more readers, more ads, and the weaker paper begins to start to wither. Because the economy is a scale of advertising, basically, is what happens. So we begin to see the emergence of the one newspaper ownership model in a particular location. There is a niche for smaller, more local papers, the Swarthmoreian and other, daily local times, because the bigger the papers get, the harder it is to cover down to the micro level. So it creates a market niche for this local product. One of the things we see as newspapers become more of a money-making enterprise is this multi-generational family ownership that had emerged begins to be a problem for the heirs, you know, the third, fourth generation. They go, you know, just give me the money. I don't want to fuss with a newspaper or a media empire. And so what some families did, there was a famous case in Kentucky where the Bingham family, the heirs just ended up fighting each other over whether to sell or keep the paper. And it was a horrible thing. You know, it just sort of ended badly for the Bingham family. And places like McClatchy, which was another family chain which owned the Anchorage paper, saw that and said, gee, what we need to do is we need to create stock ownership for the general public. And then that way, if one of the heirs wants to sell out, there's a market for them to sell to easily. We don't have to break everything up. Falls under the heading of seems like a good idea at the time, but what it does is it exposes these family-owned newspapers to the pressures of Wall Street, make quarterly profits when there's an economic downturn. You know, Wall Street still wants to see the best numbers it can, as opposed to families, which might have been more inclined to sort of ride out the downturn and try to maintain quality. So you see newspapers, these publicly owned newspapers doing cutbacks in bad economic times, which kind of, you know, depreciates the quality of the product, and you begin to see readership slipping. So one lesson we get from all this whirlwind tour through history is this. Newspapers come and go. Up to 1820, for example, one estimate was that half of over 2,000 papers that started lasted less than 2 years. Only 34 lasted a generation. And then fast forward into the next century, 1900s, 1910 to 30, 1930, there was a net drop of almost 260 papers. Much to my surprise, 1,700 disappeared, but 1,500 started. So there's a churn there that we're not seeing today. We're seeing the withering, but we're not seeing the sprouting of the new, you know, the new newspapers. Philadelphia, for example, had 13 going into the 1900s. It had shrunk to 8 by 1913. Nobody here probably remembers these, but there was the Evening Item, the Evening Times, the Evening Telegraph, the Press, the North American. Here you probably do remember the Bulletin, right? And the Daily News and the Inquirer by 1971. Those are the only three left. And, of course, the Daily News and Inquirer had common ownership. So, in some ways, it's a minor miracle that a paper like the Inquirer has survived in any incarnation from 1829. What's different this time? We're not seeing those new papers starting up. You know, there's cheaper ways to, you know, if your motivation is political, there are cheaper ways to get your message out. We do see newspapers paying attention to digital, the digital platform. Let's take a look at this, though. Here we see who gets digital ad money, and five companies dominate. I don't know if you can read which five those are, but Google, Yahoo, Facebook, Microsoft, and AOL. No newspapers on that list. The newspapers are the kind of dark brown portion of that. So the one company that... has really figured out how to do digital advertising? Ring a bell? Google? Stock price over $1,000. Now, I think I was in the middle of this internet revolution in Anchorage, and I think newspapers made a mistake giving away content for free at the beginning. And the theory was, hey, when we charge for newspapers to be delivered to your door, what you pay as a subscriber covers the cost of the newsprint and getting it to your door. Digital, we don't have to do that. No delivery, no newsprint. So let's give it away for free, and we'll get ads to make up the difference. Well, as you can see, newspapers aren't really the best at doing the ads, and in part that's because in a newspaper, there's a limited amount of stuff you're going to look at, and people will pay for the privilege to look at it, to be next to what you're looking at. On the internet, it's infinite, right? I mean, one minute you can be looking at the New York Times, the next minute you can be looking at a cat video. And so, you know, if you have an ad next to the New York Times thing, it's like, yeah, maybe somebody's going to see it, maybe not. What really works for Google is the targeting of ads. You know, you're reading a story about skiing in Utah. Well, here's an ad for a ski lodge in Utah. That's the kind of thing Google has perfected. News organizations were slow to do that for a lot of reasons. They didn't have the horsepower, they didn't have the technology, and it's a little creepy. I mean, aren't you creeped out when Google, you know, when you realize Google knows what you're reading? Yeah, it's a little creepy. But they're the ones that are making the money. These days, digital is about 15 to 20% of newspaper revenues. And as I said, Google has figured out how to do it better than the newspapers have. So what we have going into the early 2000s is the internet is sort of maturing. It's expanding its reach. We have a perfect storm of factors, bad factors for newspapers. You have the internet, you have Craigslist. You probably use Craigslist to shop or to advertise. Destroyed classified. Classified used to be 35% of newspaper revenue. Craigslist really hit it hard. The decision to go free, you give away one product for free. Why are people going to pay for print to be delivered, on the other hand? So there, you know, there's some bleeding of circulation there. And you have the Great Recession, worst downturn since the Great Depression. And that's how a company like the one I work for in Anchorage, McClatchy, went from $70 a share to $3. And the Inquirer, for example, its biggest asset was the headquarters, which is sold to Bart Blatstein for, you know, a potential casino. If the hedge fund guys made any money when they owned it, it was from selling the building. So newspapers are at bargain prices, but do we see a lot of people vacuuming them up? We'll get to that in a minute. My own news organization is Advanced Publications. It's the Newhouse family, and you probably know that they've turned a lot of papers to 3 days a week. And if you talk to the print or to the digital gurus in our universe, there, they think print edition is dinosaur. You know, forget it, kill it, just get rid of it. Literally, that's what the digital guy at my paper said to me, and it was a sobering thought for me. The Pew Foundation, when it did a study of newspaper trends, found a lot of people in the industry thought 3 days a week was going to be the model. You know, 2 days for ads in the middle of the week and Sunday. You have competition from politically oriented sites like you have left-wing, right-wing sites. You know, so if you want to do politics, you can do it through blogs. You don't need a newspaper. So there's not that impetus to do newspapers, even in the digital platform. So if we were going to look to a back-to-the scenario future for newspapers, this is what it looks like. Some people still are getting into the business, but they're not saying, hey, it's a fantastic way to make money. What they're saying is, hey, we need a strong press. We need a civic presence. We need information to have informed citizens in a democracy. Civic responsibility is a theme. We see that in Philadelphia. Jerry Lenfest buying the Inquirer at low prices from the hedge fund. But he's also involved with George Norcross, who, if any of you know New Jersey politics, know he is Mr. Politics. I mean, he's definitely got a political agenda. And then this wild card thing, one of the owners is Lewis Katz. Why does Lewis Katz really care? He made money in parking lots in the New Jersey Devils. Oh, he's sleeping with one of the editors in the newsroom. Oh, okay, so that's why he's investing in the Inquirer. He's married to one woman, and his girlfriend of many years is someone who works in the Inquirer newsroom. So that helps fuel all those crazy dynamics that are going on over there. I'll read you what Howard Kurtz said about newspapers. One theme that comes out of this history is newspapers have been kind of the playthings of rich people, rich families, mostly rich guys, sometimes women, Kay Graham, you know, at the Washington Post. Media critic Howard Kurtz said, rich men buy papers for many reasons. Rupert Murdoch has lost a fortune on the New York Post because it enhances his political influence. He overpaid for the Wall Street Journal because of its prestige. Real estate developer Mort Zuckerman became a player in New York by buying the New York Daily News. So in some ways, owning a paper can become kind of a civic ego thing, like owning a sports team. Oh, and you have John Henry, owner of the Red Sox, buying the Boston Globe from the New York Times. And you want to know how bad things have become. New York Times paid $1.1 billion for the Globe. John Henry got it for $70 million. Another entrepreneur jumping into the business with a little bit twist, not some civic motivation, but not the sort of ego, you know, regional or local civic ego thing. Jeff Bezos. Let's see what he's up to here. I'm going to skip over Walter Annenberg. Jeff going to come to the rescue? He paid $250 million for the Washington Post. He bought it personally, not through Amazon. Yeah, pocket change to him. You're like, yeah. yeah, but anyway. Yeah, they should have put it on Amazon or eBay, maybe one or the other. But anyway, so by one estimate, he paid what was called a friendship premium of $200 million. They thought that really the residual value of that Washington Post, which still has like 400,000 circulation, was only $50 million. Because it was losing money at the rate of $100 million a year when he bought it. So most observers think Bezos is going to do the Amazon bells and whistles thing. You know, he's going to give you targeted ads. He's going to give you a way to buy with one click, you know, when you see the ad and you get excited. And, you know, he's not buying it to make a lot of money. He's buying it because he likes a challenge and he wants to see if, you know, there's some way to make this work in the digital era. What will, but it's going to be an uphill climb for people that have a digital focus, like I think Bezos is going to have. For example, by one projection, newspapers are going to lose a bunch of advertising. They're going to lose market share to Google and all the biggies. Right now, they're getting about 7%, but the projection is that they're going to fall to about 3.3% of digital ads. So they're going to grow just a little bit, but the other guys are going to grow a lot faster. So written word news, digital platforms included, are still drawing people who want to make money. And I think you guys have probably heard of this guy. I'm going to skip over that one. Heard of him? Yeah, he's buying some newspapers. Let's see what he has to say. It's not a soft-headed business decision, but it's not going to move the needle at Berkshire Hathaway either. If it were the widget business, I wouldn't do it. So why is he doing it? I love newspapers. I read 5 every day. Now, one thing he says is, I'm not going to cut news whole. He says, quality is important. He says, the idea of selling less and less for more and more is not a winning system. Well, duh. But, I mean, that's what newspapers have been doing for years. They've been cutting back on content, trying to raise prices. It's just a model that has exhausted its usefulness, I think. Now, we do have another entrepreneur who is a big believer in daily newspapers in metropolitan areas. Buffett's been avoiding major metros. He turned down a chance to buy the Tampa Tribune. He turned down the chance to buy the Chicago Tribune and its papers when they went on the market. But Aaron Kusher, you know, another tech mogul, has launched daily papers. Whoops. Hope I'm not causing that interference. Long Beach Register is going daily, and he's starting, in addition, to go into Los Angeles County, you know, one of the biggest markets in the country. And everybody's looking at him saying, wow, what's he smoking? You know, not a lot of people think that that's going to work, but he's putting a lot of money into it. So we do see some progress on the digital front. You'll see there's some big numbers there for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. USA Today, digital is pretty lame. Most of their circulation is, you know, national hotel, you know, freebie type things. But, you know, there is progress on the digital front. So we're seeing a dual platform emerge, and there'll be some kind of balance struck between the two. And what I want to do to close is to ask you, what future would you like to see versus the one that you think will happen? So these last two questions here, let me open the voting on this one. What future would you like to see? Continue 7 days a week, Sunday only? I don't care. What do you think? A is 7 days a week. B is Sunday only. C is they can die for all I care. And D is I'm indifferent. C is a little more hostile than D. I mean, some people don't like newspapers, you know, because you got to recycle them. They get ink on your hands, you know. So some people are like, yeah, I don't need them.
So what about people who would be willing to pay for the journalism but don't want to
Well, let's save that for discussion. We'll go to this. We'll go to the last vote because it doesn't really segue into the last slide. But what do we have here? We have continue to the doorstep. Whoops. Let me get that at where we can see it better. Oops, sorry. Yeah, continue to the doorstep. Very good. And we have a few that are indifferent and Sunday, a few Sunday only. All right, so let's put aside sentiment here and take a hard-headed look at what do we think is going to happen? What do we predict is going to be the future here? Let me open the voting on that one. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I keep forgetting. It'd be helpful if I could see the same thing you guys are seeing. Okay, so they'll disappear eventually, or they'll keep going daily, they'll be Sunday only, or they'll be this sort of hodgepodge of platforms and publication cycles. Okay, stop the voting and we'll see how pessimistic you all are. Whoa. Yeah. What was E? I didn't think I gave you an E.
None of the above.
Yeah, there's one in every crowd. Yeah. And it is literally one. Okay. All right, well, I will tell you what I think, and then let's open the discussion, and hopefully it didn't go on too long. My feeling is that newspapers will, what I'd like to happen is what you'd like to happen, 7 days a week continuing on my doorstep at an affordable price. One of the things that really bugs me, like with the Inquirer, is I think they're just charging too much to be worth 7 days a week, so we're Sunday only. If it were more reasonable, I'd go for 7 days a week, but it isn't. What do I think will happen? I'm with most of you on D. I think there'll be this mishmash of print products on different cycles and different market niches, and some of it's in, there'll be some in print because, print is a tangible thing. It's an amazing product when you think about it. It's instantly downloaded. It's infinitely portable. You can take it anywhere. You don't need a power supply. If it comes folded, you can open it. It's expandable. There's a reason that it was the powerful product that it was for so long. But digital is just faster. It's so much more powerful. Different, audio, video, you name it. So there will be a mix of things. But they're not going to be the big money makers. You're not going to see chains evolving, owning news organizations the way you saw with newspapers in the heyday from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even into the early 2000s. That's my prediction. And now we'll take questions.
Yes.